people understand not only the challenges and the complexities, the difficulties of really the Black family in American history, but specifically within the context of slavery, to demonstrate how Black families were able to endure, how they were able to withstand just a host of challenges externally. And of course, asking Heather Williams made a whole lot of sense, given the fact that this is just a remarkable expert on the period of slavery in particular. So this was, again, thinking about the current moment. We were really thinking about how do we connect past to the present, and that essay helps us contextualize the history and to see some of the challenges that remain even to this day, to see how it connects to the period of slavery, which, of course, Heather Williams explains in this text.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. We haven't even talked about the audio version of this book, which is a magnificent extravaganza of a multitude of voices. Ibram X. Kendi and Keisha Blaine's new book. They are co-editors of 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Perk, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Maria Studio. I'm Amy Goodwin Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a development director. Our development director oversees KBOO's fundraising, donor and business outreach, and leads the development team with light supervisory duties. Our ideal candidate has at least 4 years of proven development experience in the nonprofit sector, preferably with significant foundation and major donor fundraising work. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Apply by February 24th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Wednesday. Time for some Wednesday talk radio with Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler. Stand by.
Your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now, and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your late with
And good morning, everybody out there in Radio Land. This is Paul Rowland. I am your weekly host here on Wednesday Talk Radio, one of the 7 to 8 a.m. talk radio slots here on KBOO Community Radio. And I am indeed live on the telephone, a different telephone, with my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Paul.
And, there's a I guess we could talk about the impeachment and lots of other things, but there's a really important issue regarding Native America, which we're going to be talking about today, which is the appointment or the proposal of Deb Haaland as for Secretary of the Interior and all the many challenges which she'll be facing. And we're going to be focusing on two of them. I'll just quickly introduce her. She's an enrolled member of the Laguna Pueblo and has been serving in the U.S. House of Representatives from New Mexico since 2019, and along with Charisse Davids of Kansas, is one of the first two Native women elected to Congress. Now there's a lot of opposition, obviously, from the Republicans. They're getting what a Deb Haaland tenureship as Interior Secretary might mean to their vested interests, and we're going to be talking about specifically a couple of issues, big issues that she'll be facing, which are, one, the, of course, the white right-wing extractionists like the Bundys, who were no doubt well represented their allies in the insurrection on the U.S. Capitol. And we'll also be talking about the interesting case of the freedmen, descendants of the Africans who were actually enslaved by members of the so-called five civilized tribes, the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Creek, and Seminole, and who have had a troubled relationship with those indigenous nations who have, were largely forcibly removed to what became the state of Oklahoma. Did I get that largely right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So let's first talk about the history of the Interior Department, its and its relationship to the Native Nations. Of course, the department, the Indian Affairs, grew out of the War Department, which is kind of interesting. So in a way, the Interior had a large legacy from the actual original War Department, right?
Yes. Yes, it did. It definitely did. It I would say that the approach. I mean, we are in the Interior Department, and basically the department that is also handles a lot of things like animals, like just very, you know, land. I mean, we're grouped with that rather than where we should possibly be, which is with the with the Secretary of State, with the issues having to do with policy with foreign nations, because we are actually foreign nations that the United States has holding in a very unequal relationship, which is called a trust relationship, and will not release our homeland back to us under actual sovereign terms.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, obviously, the idea of it being under the War Department obviously falls right into that, because you were actually at war at one time with the United States, and now you have your nations have a very kind of a contorted juridical status, political status vis-a-vis the United States. It's obviously very clear to you all, but not so clear necessarily to the United States. But talk a little bit more about that transition. I was doing a little reading myself about the history of the Interior Department, which was, I guess, formed in the mid 19th century.
Yeah. So it actually encompasses. So Deb Holland will actually be overseeing all the public lands in the United States, and including all the the Bureau of Land Management is under the Department of the Interior, as is the Bureau of Indian Affairs, right? So she will be overseeing all of the land that is pertinent to Native people in this country, and over which Native people have jurisdiction, not Native people, but our Native nations have jurisdiction, and so it will be an interesting clash in the sense that that of course there are a lot of public interest, particularly rural interest and right wing interest in public lands lately, and actual violent attempts to take public lands and actually convey it to the states or to private hands. And so the privatization of public lands is going to be one of the key issues that she's going to be facing. And the fact that it has been violent in nature is very worrisome.
And obviously me mentioning the Bundys is one of the big instances of that, which we saw here in Oregon. So what do you think? That's going to be a big challenge, because they basically got scot-free. And they've got, as I said, I mean, I can only imagine a lot of the people who tried to take over the Capitol were very favorable to what the Bundys believe, huh?
Well, they believe that there is federal overreach going on, and so that is part of the whole. When it's federal overreach, when it's not their guy or their woman in office, right? And so, there's been, there have been ongoing issues with these departments that she'll be overseeing, and these agencies that she'll be overseeing at the Department of the Interior. And there have been a lot of changes that were put in place under Trump, actually. And one of these, of course, was to take the originally the staff that were based in Washington, D.C., and then basically try to open up field offices and place them there so that they are more accountable to, directly accountable to these rural communities, in which case, as you saw what happened here in Oregon and Mount Hare, where you had people actively intimidating folks who worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service to the point where their families had to be hidden and moved to other parts, hidden locations around the state of Oregon, right? And even the even the sheriff's wife had to flee after her tires were slashed. So it was a way to try to intimidate staff, agency staff, to not enforce regulations and oversight. And so this is what they were attempting to do on a large scale with the staff that are based in Washington, D.C. And the tribes were not consulted about this. They found out after the fact, even though they deal with these agencies and work hand in hand with them in administering public lands.
Yeah, I was just reading here we could take a deep dive into obviously she's going to be somewhat limited. Well, first of all, we should parenthesis this with the fact that, as I mentioned at the outset, there's a growing Republican opposition. So her being confirmed is not, it's not a slam dunk. It's not a done deal, obviously, since with a slim Democratic majority, and who knows if there are going to be any Democratic defections. So obviously, people like Joe Manchin, who's very close to the extractive economy, coal, but he's also very close to the oil and gas interests as well. He who knows what he thinks about it. So I know, what do you think about that? First of all, what's your take on before we, I guess, we dive deeper into some of the more detailed things that she's going to be facing, what do you see as her chances?
Oh, I think they're quite good, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that, of course, they're going to be opposition from the Republicans. This is the same party Trump nominated some pretty terrible candidates who were confirmed to lead the Secretary to lead the Interior. And the last two guys have been Krasinski was a complete fiasco, right? He was completely unqualified to do what he was doing.
He left under an ethics cloud in not too long after. It was January 2019.
Yeah, and then of course, the next guy was no better, and so it seems I don't think that there would be any reason to it's just but it all comes down to party politics and of course these objectives that are also mainstream Republican objectives. The privatization of the commons of public lands, has been on the actual Republican the party plank. I mean, it's not just a Trump thing, and so it's quite they will oppose it because her administration of public lands and the oversight over even a lot of states. I mean, there are states in this country where most of the land is public land in the state. The states like Nevada, where Bundy is from, in order to become, to join the union, they agreed to give up these lands. And so you'll have a Native woman actually in charge of large parts of states, so it's an extraordinary moment. And of course, it's one, and she is opposed. She's an outspoken critic of fracking, particularly at Chaco Canyon there in New Mexico, and the cleanup. I mean, Laguna Pueblo, where she's from, has the largest uranium waste. It had the largest uranium mine in the world at one point. And so she has, this has been in her. I don't want to say in her sights, because that would probably freak out the Republicans, but certainly, she has a track record of better stewardship, and I'm sure that that they are worried about that.
So I don't know if just tell me if if, you know, which direction you want to go in. I was just looking again on this history of the Interior Department. You know, I started to say, who knows how deep she really wants to address these historical questions, but, you know, like the Interstate Commerce Commission was established in the Interior Department and passed the Dawes Act, which authorized allotments, and that had a big impact on breaking, you know, breaking up reservation land and privatizing land. And so, you know, if I was in that position, I would want to take it really slow, probably, and not want to take on huge historical questions. But, you know, there's a lot that this country, I'd be interested in your take on that, that, you know, a lot that has to be reckoned with that hasn't been, that's been suppressed, but needs to be dealt with, right?
Well, you know, a lot of it, that would be out of her hands. That would have to go to Congress, right?
Right.
But the that historical aspect of it, the allotment aspect, is has been problematic. Obviously, the goal was to to break up tribes. I mean, my father's reservation, the Yankton Sioux Reservation, is example. The Navajo Nation, not so much, because the majority of Navajo Nation land was not allotted out at all, except for an area over by Ramah, Navajo, and so just a tiny portion of the reservation. So you can see how the Navajo Nation, which is the size of Ireland, was able to retain its land because it was never allotted out, right? Not in any meaningful way. And meanwhile, you have the Yankton Sioux tribe, which had its land allotted out, and now most of the land is in the hands, ownership-wise, of white people, right? We are a minority on our own reservation. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, and then when you inherit this land, it's fractionated land because, well, part of it is that a lot of it's the oversight over the sale and administration of the land itself goes all the way to the Department of the Interior. I mean, imagine you had to sell your land or, right, will it out to your loved ones in the way you want to, but you had to get the approval of the Interior Secretary. And so you can see how this really gummed up the system and led to this phenomenon in Indian country, which where people have fractionated land ownership, tiny, tiny portions of land, and there's no way to get, like, there could be, you know, hundreds of owners of like 5 acres of land, right? And you don't know who all those people are, and you have to get it's like owning shares, in land, and you have to get everyone to vote to decide to make decisions. So decisions are not made, and then the land is then administered, particularly with leasing, leasing the land, by the, at the federal level, and so it's it makes it hard for tribal nations to utilize their land when they don't have title as well. That's another aspect. But of course, there's been a program in place for about for decades now that basically addresses the issue of fractionating land. And allows tribes first dibs to purchase it, and of course, famously, that happened at Standing Rock, where her father died, the tribe purchased the fractionated portions, and she had a minority share at that point. And so it's so the tribes can purchase those lands in order to make their land whole, right? And then their tribal constitutions go into play and how that is administered. But the issue, of course, has been the doctrine of discovery, which is of course an issue that is also out of her hands, because that would have to be decided really at probably by the Supreme Court, the legality of it. Which I can go ahead.
Yeah, no, I guess you're right. I guess I was thinking more as sort of an advocacy level, what she would want to bring up in terms of sort of, like maybe urging Biden and urging the administration to, not like sort of the rhetorical apologies that have been offered, but more like addressing, like the claims commission that went through and was so really very limited and very unjustly applied. But, that was one attempt to bring up these historic issues of how tribal lands have been completely unjustly dealt with.
Yeah, so with it would be excellent to see her advocating for change in policy at that level, you know, that would and bringing a real national focus to it and to these issues in a knowledgeable and comprehensive way. The issue of doctor discovery is something she could bring up, which would be really fascinating to have that discussion being had. The doctor discovery is, of course, the doctrine whereby, during the Chief Justice Marshall's tenure as Chief Justice, he was one of the earliest Chief Justices in this country, and there were a trilogy of rulings called the Marshall Trilogy that are basically the basis of Indian federal law, which is a section of constitutional law in this country, under which all federally recognized people and tribes are subject to, is this body of law. And so one of the fundamental cases, he basically had to rule on the validity of title between two men, two non-Native men, and actually one of whom was a man of color, right? And I think he's the one who won the case, actually. But he had gotten title through the state. And the other man, the white man, had gotten title from the tribe, right? So we had to determine whose title was more valid, right? And basically he decided, you know, he was Chief Justice of a brand new country. The United States didn't have much case law to go by. So he was basically picking legal precedents from other countries, in this case the Vatican, which he then consulted papal law, right? It's two papal bulls that he looked at, one from the 1490s, another from the 1550s, and basically whereby the Pope was called upon to make a decision regarding the claims between Spain and Portugal, the two different popes made this decision that this idea called the Doctrine of Discovery, whereby a European, you know, Christian ruler, basically someone under the Pope, when they land somewhere, then they put that flag down and they declare the land to be theirs. At that moment, the fee simple title of the land revert to the discovering country, right? The discoverer's country. And then and the only title that we as indigenous people enjoy is that of use and occupation, which is the title that animals have, right? And so this is still the law of the land today. I mean, I think I've mentioned before on the show that in 2005, in the case of City of Sherrill, New York versus Oneida Nation of New York, Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the decision, basically citing the Doctrine of Discovery, and to say that the Oneida Nation had no title for the land of the City of Sherrill, New York, right? And so this would be a really great thing for it to be challenged, and because it denies a fundamental human right that humans across the world have. I mean, we don't, you know, we may disagree with other nations' policies, but we don't say they don't have title to the land because they are not Christian, they are not European, and they are not discoverers. And he said the U.S. were inheritors of this status because the United States is a colony of a discovering nation. So this is a recognition of the colonial status, and also the concept that this is a Christian nation. Although, of course, this nation was not a strictly Catholic nation, that's still the fundamental basis, actually, of a lot of the title the United States possesses over other people's homelands.
And, you know, to bring it back to the Department of Interior, that trilogy of cases that you're talking about, which had, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like in order to reconcile the fact that they actually, part of the Doctrine of Discovery also meant that the discovery nation had to enact treaties, sort of bilateral treaties with the nation in order to sort of establish their right vis-a-vis the other Christian nations. So to reconcile the fact that they had these treaties, which did recognize the sovereignty, but that they basically had conquered through, you know, war and through basically just expropriation.
Not all treaties do that. Some treaties are completely different than that. And I did an article that was in The Nation back in 2014, actually addressing Clive and Bundy's sort of statement that he had his ancestral rights to the land. And there are treaties that you have to already possess sovereignty to even enter into a treaty. And in fact, the United States, some of the first treaties before the United States was recognized formally by other countries, some of the first treaties that it entered into were with Native nations. You know,
right.
The first treaties.
Because I'm just saying
we recognize the United States first before anybody else would. So our sovereignty pre-exists the United States, right? That's a legal, that's definitive legally, right? But it's there are treaties like the ones that the Shoshone had signed, which have no give up no land, which is why they've actually technically never given up any of their claims to Nevada, right? I mean, the treaty only agreed to allow passage of folks on the Oregon Trail. So it's so the treaties do different things. They're not just about giving up land, right? And so it's our sovereignty is not derived from treaties. They're an expression of our sovereignty and a recognition.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So, well, I mean, I guess obviously the indigenous point of view is often, if not always, very different from the point of view of the de facto conquering powers. So I was just saying that the relationship of between sovereign and sovereign, they had to reconcile that fact that was established through the treaties with sort of the basic de facto conquest which was happening through war, mainly warfare, and so they came up with this strange concept of domestic dependent nations, which is language in I'm not sure which of those decisions. And I guess what I'm saying is it seems like out of that idea is the Native nations were placed under the Interior Department, that idea of domestic dependent nations, and this idea that actually U.S. Congress has so-called plenary power over decisions, which means that the Congress has been able to actually unilaterally erase tribes through termination.
Yeah, the plenary power is there. I mean, the Congress can recognize a Boy Scout troop if they wanted to, right? Which, you know, that case you're talking about, the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, where they held the Cherokee Nation to be dependent in 1831. And a lot of this is because tribal indigenous nation sovereignty is a direct threat to U.S. sovereignty. And I think that reframing the discussion is really important to actually changing the dynamics and the outcomes. I think in my book Standoff, I talk a lot about that, and I did a podcast about the possibility of creating a federal indigenous government so that we are not under the thumb of the U.S. government. We have our own government that deals in a partnership with the U.S. government. And this way, remaking the relationship that is illustrated set forth in the Marshall Trilogy, and making a relationship that's based on true partnership, true sovereignty, and really addresses in a much more ethical way the history and the ongoing ramifications of colonization.
So we're almost halfway through. I think I've sort of helped take us a little bit from the more detailed discussion of the challenges of Deb Haaland, but this is always important, I think, I hope you do too, that for people to grasp this sort of basic foundation for the relationship that indigenous nations have to the federal government and the states and the municipalities and that kind of complex. But I do want to invite people to call in at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. It looks like a caller asked whether any indigenous nation has ever declared war on the U.S.
Yeah, we had wars. Yeah, I mean, there is a whole sector called the Indian Wars. I mean, although definitely. I mean, it's,
maybe they mean since that period of time. Maybe is what they mean. I don't know.
The Cherokee Nation did during the Cherokee Nation. This is kind of shocking to people. Actually, sided with the Confederacy, And it was partly this notion of my enemy of my enemy is my friend. They were still quite angry about the removal, which had occurred just, you know, barely a couple decades earlier, right? And
just say two sentences about what the removal was, please.
Yes. So in, you know, the 1830s, the Cherokee Nation were forcibly removed from their homelands, and there was a treaty party of mixed blood white slave owners in the tribe who had agreed to it, and were later murdered by other tribal members and hunted down for it. But they were forced out of their homelands in the South and forced marched to Oklahoma. And in Oklahoma, they quickly worked to reestablish themselves, the five civilized tribes. And of course, the McGirt case just last year recognized that their reservations were never de-established, and they maintained jurisdiction, if not legal title, over that land. But they were smarting after that, and they wanted to kind of get back at the United States. And so they joined forces with the Confederacy. In fact, the last Confederate general to actually give up, the Civil War would be who was a Cherokee, leader, and Stand Watie. And then the Cherokee Nation actually had to sign a treaty with the United States separately to end the war, their war with the U.S. government.
And this brings us to this very complex issue of the freedmen, which I didn't know hardly anything about. I'm sure many of our callers don't know much about. And it's one of the things you wanted to bring up in terms of what Deb Haaland will have to be facing, amongst many, many other issues. Talk about this. You referred to it, that these five civilized tribes did have slave owners amongst their members, and it has continued as a legacy to now, because they brought some of those slaves with them, and they established their own communities in Oklahoma. In fact, you were saying when we talked earlier that the famous mob violence in Tulsa that destroyed a whole business district and a whole thriving African American community was made up of a lot of freedmen. Talk about that history.
Yeah, so I actually I should mention the reason why the freedmen are relevant to Deb Haaland's nomination is that there is a petition, a change.org petition, which has been issued, is out there, which has been put forward by two Columbia University undergraduates who are themselves freedmen descendants. And they are urging Deb Haaland to do something about the what they term Jim Crow conditions that exist in the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the recognition of the rights of freedmen in these five civilized tribes. And of course, one of the reasons they were called civilized was because they had adapted some tribal members had adopted the system of slavery that was prevalent in the South, right, in the United States. And was legal in the United States at the time, and so a horrific system, which of course my tribes had no knowledge of or experience with. We were not at that point in any way had anything to do with the U.S. government or their system of brutality, and other. And so it's but the five civilized tribes, as I mentioned, with the Cherokee Nation specifically, that includes like Cherokee, Creek, Seminole, and Choctaw, and I'm forgetting one. And so, but they, all of which were removed to Oklahoma, to Indian Territory, and remove is sort of a kind word. But the Cherokee Nation, about 8% of the tribal members own slaves, right? And these were slaves that they had purchased from white people, right? And human beings who they had, and so they did bring them with them when they were moved, and so they were originally freedmen. They call themselves freedmen, and they are a tiny percentage of the population of black folks in Oklahoma. About 2% of the black community in Oklahoma are freedmen. 98% of them are what they call they arrived after statehood, site when the land was taken, when Oklahoma Indian Territory was turned into a state and the land was overrun by white people. And so the it's the Sooner, the 49ers Sooner thing. And I think they it's right now there is a real problem with how with the treaty. The Cherokee Nation actually violated their treaty, that treaty that they signed after the Civil War with the United States. In 2007, they voted to disenroll the freedmen, right? As part of the treaty with the U.S., they agreed to free their slaves and to give them citizenship, right? So this is a case in which a tribe was actually violating their treaty in modern times, in the 21st century, with the U.S. government by not maintaining the conditions of the treaty. And this was a treaty to end the Civil War and that emancipated their slaves. And so some of these 8%, these 8%ers in the Cherokee Nation were very low blood quantum. I mean, John Ridge was, according to Wikipedia, I wasn't able to confirm this, was 1/8 Cherokee by the time he was born in the 1790s, right? And then he married a white woman, so his children were 1/16, and I think his family have married white people ever since. Do you know what I mean? So we're talking about a very unusual group of Cherokee people. And
well, that's interesting. I mean, it obviously not to, not that we or anyone needs to or can absolve anyone historically, or, you obviously know more about this history than I do, but it would be interesting to know that maybe the majority of those slave owners were actually people who were more either acculturated as white or actually had through marriage or through their blood was actually more from European.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, they were. I mean, it's and there was actually a very large party in the Cherokee Nation that were abolitionists. I mean, 80% of them. You have the Kiowa Party, and of course there are two federally recognized Cherokee tribes in Oklahoma. The Eastern Band Cherokee are still in North Carolina, but the two federally recognized Cherokee nations that are in Oklahoma proper are the Cherokee Nation, which is the much larger one, and in the United Kiowa. And so it's there was a lot of opposition to slavery within the Cherokee Nation itself. What happened in the South for generations before removal was that white men were, because the Cherokee Nation was matrilineal and power went through the mother line, right? White men, white traders found it very convenient to marry very powerful Cherokee women, and then their children would then be in position, their sons would be in position of power because the power went through the mother's line. And so that's why you have, I think he was born in 1795, by the time John Ridge is born, who was the leader of the Treaty Party, you have someone who is mostly white, right? So that's what happened. And then they, so right now what's going on today is that, there was trumpeted in the news the fact that the Cherokee Nation, under their treaty, was also allowed a congressional delegate to the U.S. Congress, right? And so they actually finally invoked that part of the treaty and sent a delegate, Kim Teehee, to the U.S. Congress. But while there in 2019, she actually began advocating so the Cherokee Nation lost their case in court. They were forced to obey the treaty and re-enroll their freedmen. So the freedmen have been re-enrolled in the Cherokee Nation since 2007. And in fact, there is a freedman who she is running for office with the Cherokee Nation. That may go to the Cherokee Supreme Court to decide. And so they really do, I would say, in my estimation, and of course I'm not a citizen of any of these five civilized tribes, but in my estimation, with reporting I've done and interviews, I would say they are being given a de facto second class citizenship, and the same thing with the Seminole Nation, where their freedmen have sued them, and they have gotten citizenship as well. But there is sort of this non-voting, non-fully rights. And I personally, this is my personal belief, And of course, I have no say over what any other tribe decides to do as a non-citizen. But I believe that for our nations to be taken seriously on the international level, which is of course what we're talking about here, is that they not discriminate based on race, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, this is the U.S. government in those three cases. They challenged the Cherokee Nation, the original Marshall Trilogy. They were deeply threatened and challenged the Cherokee Nation's right to naturalize citizens, particularly these son-in-laws. And so that right has not been, we haven't had that right in a long time. And so, but that is a part of sovereignty. And so, but these folks have been I don't know to what extent every Freedman family is continuing to maintain cultural and contact with the Cherokee Nation. But to what extent has any Cherokee family really, because, people move, they go places, and the Cherokee Nation uses descent, not blood quantum, for enrollment, so you don't have to maintain that constant contact generation after generation. What I feel is neither here nor there, since I'm not a citizen. But this is what the petition is asking Deb Haaland to consider. When Kim Teehee was there in 2019, there was a bill that administers HUD housing to tribal nations. And it's a massive bill. And in that bill, there has been, for quite a while, one little section that actually, I think it's section 8.3 or something, where they actually say in the bill that that the Cherokee Nation has to distribute these funds without any sort of discrimination against freedmen. Right? It's right there in the bill. And so Kim Teehee was pushing to have that section removed from the bill because it discriminated unfairly. It unfairly targeted the Cherokee Nation specifically. It's a bill that is for all tribes. Right? And so Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, has been a huge proponent of the Freedmen cause in Congress. And she said, we will actually put all five civilized tribes in that section, so you won't feel discriminated. The petition mentions that particular bill and what happened, and demands that Deb Haaland deal with this issue and make sure that the freedmen's rights are equally protected under the law.
So I want to, I'll just ask you to continue talking about what you see as important in terms of these and other issues with Deb Haaland. I just want to just make one quick observation, which is, from my memory, that whole issue of the way that that European Americans, white people, claimed the land and resources through marrying marrying women, members. Didn't that same thing replicate again in Oklahoma during the oil boom? I know there's I forget which tribe it was, but I know there's some really bad history there through a lot of different machinations, but I think through marriage was one of them as well.
Yeah, I think all the Osage in particular, I think, might be the tribe you're thinking of. And they're actually Martin Scorsese is working on a film right now. They're doing casting. I think they already did casting in Oklahoma, which covers that. The FBI, interestingly enough, was actually created to investigate these murders of Native women by their white husbands. And
that's right. They married them and then they murdered them. That's even
Yeah. And so, yeah, so Martin Scorsese is working on a film about it. And there's a great novel written about it by a Native author, Linda Hogan. If you don't want to just purchase the White Guy's History book, what is it called again? It's a good, I remember that being assigned that, Mean Spirit. The book Mean Spirit is an excellent novel about those murders during the Oklahoma oil boom. And
that's a hard book to read. I read that a while back myself. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Martin Scorsese is working on a book about a movie about that. Let me get the title of that. It's like, it's a film, and people are. I'm hoping it's good. And Killers of the Flower Moon. That's the name of the film and the book as well. And that's really where the FBI got started to basically investigate those murders.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to draw back a little bit from this really focused view of this incredible and important historical episode that, as you say, Deb Haaland is going to have to deal with. But to the whole issue of relations between the indigenous people and African descendants of the African slaves, African Americans, is a big issue. And there's been, you know, there's been all sorts of relations. There's been, you know, communities that were where people lived together and struggled together, where, you know, escaped slaves actually escaped to some of the, you know, like the Seminoles in Florida and some of the other tribes in the Southeast. But there's also been episodes of tension and conflict and, well, outright slavery, as you're talking about. So do you see this, the issue of the freedmen, as being sort of an important case of those relationships?
Well, certainly Deb Haaland is in a position to take a lead in the discussion, right, in a way that even though she's not a citizen of those nations as the Interior Secretary, she certainly has a position to sort of, lead by moral authority, right? And and so it's, I mean, and I know that I've actually spoken to a Cherokee tribal member who is also, you know, he's a Black Cherokee citizen, and he also is an advocate for the freedmen. And he told me that, Eli Grayson, he told me that they had done a fundraiser for Deb back when she was first running for Congress in 2017. And he picked her up from the airport, and he was telling her about the freedmen issue, and she actually she didn't even know that tribes owned slaves at that point. I mean, she didn't know that history, and she was completely shocked. And so it is. I mean, that was just what 3.5 years ago, and so it is an issue which, you know, a lot of Native people don't know these things. They don't know that. That the five civilized tribes owned slaves or declared war against the, you know, in Congress with the Confederacy, and very strange history that most tribes do not share. So she, as a Laguna Pueblo member, she had no knowledge of the Cherokee Nation's role up to fairly recently. So I'd be interested to see how she responds to it. Of course, she has a law degree. So she's very familiar with Indian federal law, and it'll be interesting to see what she does. Because I don't think she's ever been asked to address this issue before in a public way. You know, we know her stance on, you know, fracking and the use of public lands clearly, but all I know is, you know, interpersonally she was shocked and by the discovery of this. Whole history there in Oklahoma and the South, and we'll see what she does. And I think that you know, certainly the young women who have put forward this petition has received a lot of support, and they do have, I think, definitely have the moral high ground on this issue, mm-hmm. And I think the treatment of the freedmen reflects on tribal sovereignty, and it's very important to, we all have a stake. We all are under the same federal law, Indian federal law, all tribes, all 574 of us. We have very distinct and different histories from each other, you know, but we're all held a moral account in the public sphere because the public doesn't differentiate us, right? And so certainly, Black Lives Matter activists have brought up this issue, the issue of the freedmen. And although, ironically, speaking to freedmen in Oklahoma, they say that the Black community there has not been always very supportive of them because they view them as, you know, having a more special relationship with tribes, a more direct relationship. And obviously, they're citizens of tribes. But in fact, when there was a documentary was being made about Greenwood, and Greenwood, you know, that was actually one of the things that came out of the freedmen's emancipation was they also got land from the tribes. So they were in a very good position. They, you know, where so many emancipated, Black families did not receive land, did not get their 40 acres and a mule after the Civil War. But many freedmen did. They got 50 acres and so, or even more. So they were able to really be the financial basis for Black excellence and success in Oklahoma. And Greenwood is an example of that.
That's the African American district in Tulsa, right?
Yes. Yeah. Of course, the Tulsa, the riots there that happened in the early part of the century, and which have been featured in a lot of TV shows lately. So it happened in 1921. It was termed a race massacre, where they completely burned down the homes and businesses in Greenwood, and it was also called the Black Wall Street, or the massacre, the Tulsa pogrom, and the land was originally owned by a freedman, and a lot of the this was adjacent to a tribal nation, and so that's a history that. That the freedmen are proud of, but have been forgotten by other Black Oklahomans, and which they had to bring up and show with titles and deeds that this is in fact true, you know. There's a deep tie to that, and that's often been forgotten.
That's just a really fascinating and really important history, and this is, after all, Black History Month. So that's a really interesting take on that. I've let a lot of time go by. I haven't reintroduced ourselves. I'm Paul Rowland. This is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular weekly host, and I'm also on the phone from her residence is Jacqueline Keeler, who is an enrolled member of the Navajo or Diné Nation, and through her father is connected to the Dakota, which my mind is blank. Dakota tribe?
My father is a citizen of the Yankton Sioux tribe.
Yankton Sioux, sorry. I just blanked on that for just a second.
Sorry.
Just want to get it right. And we're talking about Deb Haaland, the proposed new Secretary of the Interior, who knows when they're going to get to her. It's kind of, now that there's impeachment, everything's kind of slowing down. Any idea what the timeline might be on hearings for her?
Yeah, well, I see the Washington Post is reporting that GOP opposition to Haaland as Interior Secretary is growing, right? And that in the local BLM headquarters, there's lobbying going on from local rural white communities' interests and definitely energy interests. You know, I think one of the things that they really happened under the Trump administration was there was a free-for-all in leases, particularly energy leases. And of course, he opened up ANWR. He sold fracking leases, uranium leases, everything you could think of. There was a huge fire sale that happened, for energy in our public lands. And so in a lot of that, there's not a huge demand for some of it, so they got it at dirt cheap prices. And in fact, the ANWR, leases, hardly anybody purchased them. I mean, there wasn't a lot of interest, actually.
That's Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge.
Yes.
Yeah. And while I'm talking about acronyms, just to clarify, when you say BLM in this context, obviously it means Bureau of Land Management, not
yes.
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, there
which,
was
will be interesting.
I'm sure there was some confusion over that. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we haven't had any callers. This has been really important information. Maybe if we might get one caller before the end of the hour, which is rapidly approaching, 503-231-8187, or you can just relay your comment or question to Sonia, who's operating the board, and she can write it down on Facebook where I can see it, and I'll ask it. Let me just open it up to you. I know there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot that's been going on with Standing Rock is one thing, but maybe anything more regarding Deb Haaland and what she'll be facing, or whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah, I think we have to remember this is a really momentous a moment where a Native woman will be in charge of vast areas of the country, of the entire nation, right? if her nomination is not scuttled. And it's an interesting moment, and I think that we should take some time to think about it, you know. And what I would like to see happen politically permanently is that, you know, maybe that should always be an indigenous position. You know, I don't know. An act of recognizing that history and dealing with it. It's going to be really interesting, and I think that, you know, Deb Haaland will do an excellent job in the position. Of course, I do worry about the pushback that she will also receive, and as you can see, some of it is sometimes violent in nature.
Well, of course, she'll have the Bureau of Indian Affairs under her, too, so it'll be really interesting how she addresses that, an agency that has been fraught with a lot of, let's just say it, corruption and mismanagement over the years and decades.
Yes, yeah, I think that it's that's definitely been the case, and there's a lot of, and changes are happening at many levels. We even had the deputy solicitor position, I think at the BLM and at the to be a Native woman as well, which before, of course, was filled by Karen Bud Fallon, who was the Clive and Bundy's attorney in the early 1990s, who is the originator of the county supremacy ideology, which is very popular right now with this rural movement, whereby the county itself is the supreme sovereign in the country, so that they can then and the sheriff is, of course, the supreme sovereign within the county itself. And I go over that history of that ideology in my book, Standoff, as well.
And, of course, the Bundys were firm adherents, and many of the people who participated in the occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge a few years ago were adherents of that. In fact, there's even a couple of, I think, Oregon county sheriffs that were very sympathetic to that.
Yeah, not as many as I hope, because when I did that big signing where people would sign over their leases or final things, only one guy from Arizona came. You know,
I was there. I was actually there when that was. Yeah.
But, I mean, most of the ranchers I interviewed there around Malheur, there in Harney County, they said that they were pleased with the compact that had been negotiated over several years, the land use compact. And so because their voice was heard, they were part of the process. So it was the tribes, and so were the tribes, and also, you know, the Audubon Society and other groups, with the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Malheur Land Use Compact is really regarded nationally as the gold standard for a cooperative way of determining the use of land in our public lands. So, but of course, that got almost no news coverage during Ammon Bundy's takeover.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just goes to show that it really is, I don't know, these extremists, these ideologues, like the Bundys are a really small percentage, just like the people who took over the Capitol were a small percentage, but they get an outsized attention, and
Well, they are informing public discourse. I mean, you know, the folks that took over the Capitol may only be a small percentage of folks, but they are, a usual group. I think the Atlantic Monthly did a great analysis of everyone who participated, what the kind of different groups they represent. And but also, you know, they are given a huge voice. And I think last polling I saw, 70% of Republicans believe that Biden stole the election.
Right.
And I think that was just 2 weeks ago that polling came out. I have to check to see where it's at now, but that's still a big chunk of the party. I mean, and you know, freaking Lynn Cheney, you know, Dick Cheney's daughter, you know, the congresswoman from Wyoming, she's facing huge challenges back home. I mean, you have to realize that only she, you know, she actually supported, she crossed the line to support the impeachment of Trump, and she barely hung on to her leadership position there. But she, is facing, you know, huge pushback. When you think that only 30% of her electorate possibly supports her in this, then you can see how it is politically how the Republican Party continues to politically be pushed to the right, to the extreme right. And so, it's going to be interesting. The next year, I think we're going to see more violence, and it's not going to end. And it will be very challenging to have a Native woman as head of the Department of Interior with that sort of violence going on.
Indeed. Well, all we can do is wish her all the best, eh?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much again. Always a great pleasure to have you on, Jacqueline Keeler, on my radio program. And we got to sign off for now. Thanks, Jackie.
Sure. Thanks, Paul. Good talking to you.
Okay.
So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful if you got the sense to take care of your source of perfection. Mother Nature, she's the daughter of God and the source of all protection. Look right now and you will see she's only here by the skin of her teeth as it is. So take heart and take care.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282B.